This is a conspiracy. That's what this is. One big damn conspiracy! And everyone's in on it! I know what's going on.
Did IQs just drop sharply while I was away?
The person is smart. People are dumb, panicky, dangerous animals, and you know it.
Did you see the memo about this?
Just when I think you couldn't possibly be any dumber, you go and do something like this.
Don't you see what this means? This is it! This is the beginning of everything! I've been waiting for this all my life!
Welcome back to another episode of your Missing the Point podcast. Today, I have a little bonus episode for you. That's right. I have another installment of Move Your Minds. Yep, another one for you to listen to. This was a great one. It's a little film called Liar Liar, the 1997 comedy fantasy starring Jim Carrey. Again, this guy's films are just outlandish. Not only is he comedy gold, he's hilarious, he's fantastic in everything he does, but there's always something hidden away in his films, something blatant and something squirreled away that you can only discern through active eyes and ears. Anyway, this one's a personal favorite of mine. I've always found it as a great comedy to watch. It has a lot of elements on it about fatherhood and where your priorities should lie, but it's also got some really, really esoteric stuff in there, particularly about wishes and color and how those things play into how we make people think and act. You definitely see that in this episode. This was a great one to break down, Moral Bob. Absolute blast. Hope you guys enjoy it. So sit back, grab a coffee, put your feet up, and enjoy this bonus episode.
Everybody, welcome back to another episode of Movie Minds. I'm your not so humble host, Moral Bob, and as usual, I got my partner in crime, Drew Missen from Missing the Point podcast. Drew, thanks for coming, and let's see if this internet will stay stable enough that we can actually crank this thing out.
Yeah, touch wood, mate. Looks like I gave a virus to the computer. Because I'm regular sick people, I don't have the spicy cough. It's fine.
How are we supposed to know anyway? You can't do a solid
test. I know, right?
You can't do a reliable test. So, I mean, you could have monkeypox. You could have, you know, COVID. You could have AIDS for all we know. You know, they're all the same thing, right? The only thing that makes us sick is acetosis. So...
Yeah, well,
that's when it's all breaking down to the scientific aspect of what makes us sick, it's acetosis.
The only thing that out of that that rules me out is I'm not a person who sleeps with men or identifies as sleeping with other men, so that definitely rules me out. I'm fine on that part.
I don't know, man. I think I identify as a lesbian, so I mean, is it just gay sex or does it have to be penis in butthole sex?
I think it has to be the latter.
Didn't we do this in the 80s, folks? Am I watching a rerun? This is ridiculous.
History doesn't repeat, it rhymes.
Right. But
it's still monkeys again, right? So,
right. It's still butt sex with monkeys. And then in the gay community, it sounds a lot like AIDS.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Jeez. Anyway.
All right. So
that's not what we're here for.
No, we're not talking about that. We're not here to talk about butt sex, ironically. Because it's in a lot of Jim Carrey's films. There's a lot of sodomy in previous ones. Anyway, today we are looking at Liar Liar, which should be an interesting one because I think I noticed a lot of the more hidden stuff. Like, as usual, we've got that team dynamic going where I see the less obvious stuff and you just see the blatant things straight away. But let's see what we've got.
Yeah. Yeah. I try to watch it from like a normie's eye, right? Like where something might be fishy or somebody that, you know, listens to Joe Rogan, you know, like not somebody that's as deep as us, maybe just the slightly conspiracy, the person that's heard of the Illuminati and the Rothschilds, you know, like, you know, your typical entry level, you know, conspiracy person, you know, not the super, super deep. And in this one, man, I'm very interested to hear your take on stuff because I was kind of looking for some more in-depth stuff. And, you know, I just didn't see it. I didn't see a ton of it, but I didn't go into the color or word magic stuff like you had mentioned in a text. So we'll get into it.
There's definitely a fair bit there, but I think we need to point out that this doesn't follow the usual Jim Carrey like trope. Like it's got his physical comedy, his facial expressions, all that right. type of stuff he's well known for. But usually in films that we've seen in the past, like The Truman Show, Me, Myself, and Irene, he's portrayed as the downtrodden good guy, the really nice guy that falls on hard times. This time he starts off as the scumbag.
Right.
It's very noticeable he's a scumbag.
Yeah, yeah. He actually has like a character arc that,
yeah.
you know, he starts out as this just... So Liar Liar, it came out in like, what, 97 or some shit? It was a long time ago, maybe early 2000s. I didn't look at the year that it came out. But it's about a dad who's a lawyer, who's a defense attorney. So he is usually defending, you know, shitty people. So he has to lie a lot and he wins, you know, and he's a good lawyer, but he's a piece of shit, as you want your lawyer to be. I tell people all the time, you don't really want to like your like if you like your lawyer, they're probably not doing a good enough job. So it opens, the opening scene of Liar Liar is a classroom, and you don't see it yet, but you hear them spell the word work. That's the first word in the movie is work. And I thought that was very telling. Like, they spell it out, and then it opens with them doing like a, what does your parents do? We've seen it in Kindergarten Cop, and we've seen it in Liar Liar.
Who is your daddy and what does he do?
Boys have a penis and girls have a vagina. We'll have to cover that movie on another show.
Definitely.
So it comes into this cute little kid with a little like Beatles haircut. And this is Jim Carrey's character's son, Fletcher Reed's son. And
yeah, Max.
He's Maximus. And the teacher asks him what his dad does for a living. And he says, he's a liar. And the teacher's face is just awesome. She's like, what? And he's like, oh, he's a liar. He talks to judges and stuff. And she's like, oh, you mean a lawyer?
Yeah.
Like, no, he was right the first time.
Yeah. He got it straight away. That's, really good spotting with the word magic there. I think it'd be beneficial before we jump into like the main story arc. I think I need to unpack the word magic of people's names first. And
okay.
That might help us reflect back on the storyline. So Fletcher is our main character, as you said. Fletcher, first name, is one of a French word in origin, which means feathers or arrows, for someone who places arrows, feathers on an arrow, rather. And Reed means ruddy or red in Old English. So he's literally an arrow red or a red arrow. The red arrow is associated with the Star of Chaos. I'm not sure if you've ever seen it. It's an eight-pointed star that has arrows, red arrows on the end of it. And this kind of links us back to his chaotic retelling of the story. His life is going to become very chaotic based on his name. In dreams, red arrows represent burdens and responsibilities and the refusal to move on to something productive. So in a nutshell, as we find out in the film, it nails who he is.
Again, like I knew there would be something with his name, but I looked at like the over, like what is his name? You know, it's not Christoph like you would notice in Truman Show where it's like, okay, that's clearly like Christ or True Man. This is a little deeper and it's I love, like, it has to be intentional. I've said it before.
Has to be. Absolutely
has to be. This has to be intentional because it just ties to everything so well that this couldn't have just been some made up name. And I thought about that like years and years ago when I'd watch movies. I'm like, how do they come up with these people's names? Like, cause you'll hear like, what was it? It was, I forget what movie I was watching, but it was around like 2012 that this movie came out, and it had like, I forget what politician's name, but it had their exact name in it, a politician that was running for president. And I was like, that's not an accident. Like that, you just happen to come up with a fictitious character that has the same name as somebody running for president. Like, come on.
Yeah, it's very on the nose, isn't it?
Like that, there's got to be one person that just comes up with the names of the character. Like they're told the storyline or whatever, or they're given the script and they're like, all right, these people need names.
This actually makes me wonder whether, like, there's that side of it where it's very intentional, or these are all stories that have already been played out hundreds of thousands of times and we're just regurgitating them from some kind of source.
Well, it has to. Like, a lot of the movies that you see, a lot of the modern movies that we see are remakes. And you'll realize that, oh, shit, they made that movie in the 50s. Like, there was something, I forget what it was, but there was a movie that I saw the other day, and it right below it, like on Amazon, it's like suggested movies, and it was the original one. And I was like, fuck, that's a remake.
It's a remake.
Like, damn it, dude.
Star Wars is a remake of Seven Samurai. It's like it all been done before.
Yeah. Well, and that goes to that these people aren't creative. You know, they're
just tapping into the Akashic record.
Yeah, they can't create. They can only alter.
You know? Yeah, that's they can recycle. They can recycle the same story.
Right.
It's like the names and places have been changed, but essentially it's the same story, isn't it?
Well, isn't that like the when you see a true story, whether it's a movie or a TV show, and it's like, this is a true story, but the names and places have been changed.
Exactly right.
that's just everything, I guess.
All right, the last part of Chaos Magic that really brings this home. In Chaos Magic, you're said to experience many obstacles and setbacks before achieving success and prestige. So you're going to be put through trials and tribulations. You're going to be put through a ritual of making yourself look like a fool. You're going to be put down before you achieve the success and prestige that you're wanting out of that magic. So that's quite interesting. Then we jump into Audrey. Audrey's his ex-wife. She maintains his surname. So they haven't divorced yet in the film. Her name, Audrey, is from Anglo-Norman ancestry, which means noble or strength, and it's often associated with the supernatural. And my gleaming of this is that she's in a noble pursuit on her life and demonstrates strength in standing for her son and Fletcher's relationship. Even while she's dating another man and her life is progressing, she's still actively fighting for Fletcher and Maximilian to have a strong father-son relationship, when there's plenty of situations where she could have tucked tail and run in that whole storyline.
Yeah, she's like the guardian angel.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, then we've got... She is kind of this, you know, you see her and she's always kind of lit up. Like, she's all kind of this angelic person. She doesn't have any flaws that she presents on screen. You know, she's the perfect mother. She's trying to do what's best for her son. And like, she's the angel.
Yeah, she's the epitome of the perfect mom. She's the mama bear. And she's not what going through the tropes that we see today, where unfortunately you see a lot of separated families and it's not amicable and it's the worst possible situation for the child involved. Whereas this time in this film, possibly because of when it was made, we can see characters actively trying to make it work, which is something I think a lot of people need to reflect on and try and make the best outcomes for their kids, regardless of your own relationship and situations. We jump from Audrey into Max. So Maximilian, their son. His name, as you know, is from the Roman family Maximus, which means the greatest. He's the greatest of the Reds or the Reeds. Throughout the entirety of the film, I don't know if you picked up on this, this is where color magic comes into us. He is constantly wearing the color red in some form or another. We first see him wearing a red shirt when he's introduced. We see him wearing a red jacket, a red backpack when he's going to leave. The links of the color red are all the way out throughout this film. So it's not just his name Reed meaning red, we actually see him portraying the color of his name.
Man. And see, like, I had somebody ask me, like, you know, before like maybe we are just like diodes, right? Humans are just diodes and we're used for energy travel, right? And so them doing this in these movies, it channels some kind of energy through us, whether we know it or not, whether we recognize these things, they're put there for a reason. And it's to generate some kind of energy, you know, do something subconsciously with our energy, like, because why else do it, right? Like, what's the point? Unless there is some kind of benefit to whoever's controlling this shit. But that's
got to be. Do you ever think there's like the screenwriters and they're coming up with the basic storyline, right? And they're bouncing ideas. And then a level below them in some kind of basement with a single light over a round table there. What colors do we give the main character with this name? It has to be so perfect.
Right.
And they're going a level deeper than what the surface level writers are doing.
Right. Yeah. Like the person that finds all the names. There's somebody that's like, yep. And we got to give them a red backpack. We got to have them wear red the whole time. Like there's people that take the script. You know, this basic script about a liar lawyer dad that sucks, you know, maybe that was a real script at some point in time. And then it's given off because, you know, they're like the CIA has been involved in like 800 movies and over 1,000 TV shows. And so maybe this script gets handed to the CIA and they're like, all right, well, okay, well, this dude's name's got to be Fletcher Reed.
This and this.
Yeah, yeah. This is what the names are going to be. This is what they're going to be wearing. These are the colors that are going to be in each scene, you know, and they add that second layer. It's like when you'd see old animation where they were doing the next scene of animation, they'd have a clear sheet
you could see
they
the
were
flip.
Drawing on. Yeah, you could see them flipping back and forth between the pages to make the next scene. And that's what they're doing is they're adding that next layer to it.
It's definitely there. It's far more to it than what the average Joe thinks. So we jump from Max, who's the greatest of the Reds, to Jerry, which is the current boyfriend or new man on the scene. Jerry's the name of British origin. His name is an abbreviation of Jerome, Gerald, or Jeremy, which means spear. This comes into play later on. Spears are sharp weapons, which are used in protection and battle. These pointed objects may be harmful to some, but they're a symbol of power and pride to others. He also has red hair. So we're seeing the red symbolism come through. I'm going to leave the spear stuff there until it comes later on in the discussion, but it actually works its way in, which is quite interesting. So we've got Jerry, which is a new boyfriend, generally a nice guy. A lot of people would refer to him as a cuck, but anyway, he has a lot of good qualities there. We see Greta, and Greta's his secretary, lovely old woman. Her name is Persian or Iranian and it means creature of light. She's wearing yellow when we first see her, which is representation of sunshine, hope, and happiness. And it's ironic as her constant work keeps Fletcher happy. It also represents clarity and honor and loyalty, which we see repeated later on in the film when she bails him out of jail.
And she asks him questions that he can't ignore, right? Like she asks for clarity in some of her questions about,
she's his
about
moral
situations
compass.
That she's not sure about.
Yep.
You know? Like, were you actually sick when I had to, or like, could you afford my raise and you just didn't want to shell it out? Like she does exactly that. She asks for clarity in some cloudy situations or where she doesn't really trust what he had said. So, and then you see her come full circle at the end where she comes
back. It's all there.
In.
It's all there.
Yeah. It's so insane.
That's right.
How deep this shit is. Like, it's just so crazy.
That is. And the last one, Samantha Cole, which is his client during the film. So Samantha's a woman who we find out has cheated on her husband 7 times, not once, not twice, but 7. And she's trying to sue her husband for a bigger payout. She's offered like $2 million and she wants more and she wants the kids and everything, the whole kit and caboodle. Samantha's name in origin is name of God or God has heard and flower blossom. So I'm referring more to the flower blossom at this point because she's not very a godly woman. We see her first wearing a gold and pearl necklace in the shape of a flower. Her dresses throughout the film have really intricate gold woven flowers throughout all of them. And Cole, in biblical meaning, means victory. So she's a flower of victory in the context which represents itself later in court when the court hearing is presided and we find out who wins the court case. So right. It's pre-telling the story in symbolism before we even say it.
Yep. And, you know, if she's this flower or whatever, she's also not an ugly person. And she's also put on display like a flower. because she's always showing her breasts the entire time. She's always done up very, you know, in nice clothes and all fit.
Showing, I think they must have been like a fabric shortage in the early thousands, because those things were on display like the Hindenburg. They were popping. Yeah. They were popping.
Yeah, the entire time. Well, I mean, they're really trying to relay the message that she's slutty.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, she is the slutty housewife.
She's the sex magic of the whole situation.
Right. Yep. Though you do see that in other aspects. She is that sexual energy that's in the, and not, it's the deviant sex, right? It's the forbidden or the not pure sexual energy, because I don't think
just, it's not sex just out of sex love or bad. Sex out of appropriation. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's the deviant side of this. She's the whore, for lack of a better term.
She is.
So definitely. she's like the scarlet whore.
She is 100%.
She's very much flower. Like a succubus. So, anyway, yeah, dude, see, this is why I love doing these with you, because you make me see it in a different way. I watch it like the regular person, and then I let you blow my fucking mind with all the shit I missed.
All right. So that's just the character breakdown to help. Hopefully it'll help us understand a bit more as we're talking about it.
Right.
So we've had Fletcher. He's won his first case at the start of the movie, and he's come out and he's on his way to see his son. It's so important to him, but he's stopped by a reporter or someone from the law firm and says, you need to do an interview. And he instantly reverts back to his own selfish need of, you know what? I've got to do this interview. How's my hair look? I could take a few minutes. So he's already prioritizing his career and his needs over his son straight away. And that reinforces him being a scumbag and not the usual nice guy that we see in Jim Carrey films.
Right. Yeah. So then his son is sitting on the stoop waiting for his dad. Like, he's waiting for his dad. Tomorrow's his birthday. He's going to get to go spend his birthday with his dad. He's excited. And as usual, his dad's late because he did this thing. And he still shows up like, Maximus, hey, like, you know, he pulls into the driveway like the hero, like, hey, I have arrived. Like,
he's a hero just for showing up. Doesn't matter, he's an hour late, but he's still showing up.
Right. And his son, that's all his son cares about, you know, because I watched this kind of for the first time as a father, because I probably haven't seen this movie. I've seen this movie probably 100 times, but I probably haven't seen it in and seeing it, dude, this movie is so upsetting as a father. Like, it's so upsetting as a dad. But he shows up and his son is excited to see his dad. So that kind of sets the precedent in at that time. You realize that he's late all the time. Like, his son is constantly looking up to him and looking forward to seeing him, and he's constantly being let down. But he gets his son and he talks about going and seeing wrestling that night for his birthday. And so after this scene, you know, it kind of, he picks him up from his mom's and the boyfriend shows up, Jerry shows up, which in the only kind of aggressive move that Jerry does the entire movie in front of Fletcher, he just walks up and kisses Fletcher's ex-wife. And that was the most you get out of Jerry the entire time. It's the only time he shows kind of a power move. But then Jerry says that he'll see Max later. And then Max goes with his, and they,
then he has to return to the office. So he takes Max with him to the office. Max goes into his office room while he's speaking with his receptionist. And he's doing everything under the sun not to call back all these clients, his mother, all these people who want to get a hold of him, because his time's too important to speak to his clients, right? So he says he needs a cover for him. And she says, I can't cover for you all the time. He says, tell him I'm sick. Tell him I've got strep throat. No, no, wait, a virus. What's going around? And his receptionist says, Asian flu? Oh, that's a good one. Yeah. Like,
even what my wife,
preconditioning do my we wife need?
Was like, holy shit. Yeah. And then they start talking about being a partner. And he's like, oh, whose ass do I have to kiss to be a partner? And sure as shit, one of the partners is behind him as he's saying this. And he turns around and he's like, oh, didn't even notice you there. And they get into a conversation about the partnership and a new case that has come in. And she basically tells him, if this is worth a lot of money to the firm, And if you take this case, you know, you're almost guaranteed to be partner. So she gives him this case. And of course, he takes all this paperwork into his office, plops it on his desk. And his son, disappointed, looks at him and says, "We're not going, are we?" And so it's setting up this precedent that, you know, work, his work trumps his kid, and he'll do what he needs to do to get ahead, do anything to get ahead in his career. And it just sets it at, like, I think the psychological bit of this is telling us where we are in society, and that our kids don't matter. You know, I think that what this speaks of for society, most people can relate to this stuff. And, you know, they see this movie as silly, but they don't understand the messaging behind it is, yes, you will put your work before your kid every time.
It's even the mainstream messaging of this is, it's so much deeper, just like you said. During this whole, you can see his son physically slumps down when he says, "We're not going out," and he drops down in his chair a little bit. His dad's like, "Oh, sorry, buddy, I've got to do my work." This whole time, and I've got it in my notes, and I even forgot to mention it, that he's wearing a red tie.
Oh,
so he's Fletcher red again. So color symbolism is there again. So he ditches his son. He decides to not go to the wrestling with him, which we all know wrestling is fake and made up, which is not in itself to society in general. And what happens after that? So he's got this client, and what happens next?
All right, so he takes his son back to his mom's house, right, for a party, and he has to go back to work, but then he's going to come back to the party. That's the timeline. I guess he's got to drop his son off at the mom's, but he's coming back for the party. So then he goes back to the office again. Like, what day is it that they're having a party? Like, seems like it's a Saturday, but he's going back to the office. So he goes back to the office, and he has a meeting with Samantha Cole to really lock down him representing her. This all moves really fast, too. Like, it's crazy. It goes from him getting the case to meeting with the client to being in trial inside of 24 hours.
Like, yeah, it probably takes place over 2 days. There's the little pre-bit, and then the second part.
Yeah, there's at least a week's worth of shit that happens within 24 hours. So maybe that's another thing there, too, is that they're pushing in this rapid timeline to just show us how fast life moves and the speed of life, you know, because I don't know if you've noticed, but the timeline has seemed to have been sped up and even confirmed by science.
Yes, climate now. Change.
Yeah, it's climate confirmed change. By it's science. Climate. Our days are getting shorter.
And they're blaming it on... I'm such a distraction. Sorry to the listeners for going into this. But they're blaming it on ice caps melting and throwing off weight on one side of the planet so it spins faster. Well, what impact did the glacial span of the Northern Hemisphere have? Was the planet slower then?
Yeah.
Did people not age as much? Is that why people in the Bible live 900 years? Like, what the actual fuck?
It's they're so
telling silly. So many lies.
It's so silly. Well, and the amount that the day has gotten shorter is like 0.00015 thousandths of a second or some shit. Like, it's
blew my schedule out. I can't get things done anymore.
Like, yeah, like it's inside the margin of error. Like, a slight miscalculation, one tiny little, you know, thousandths of a decimal point is the wrong number, and you could get this answer. So, there's no definitive. It's not like it was like 4 minutes slower, and it's outside of the margin of error. Anyway, we could do a whole fucking tangent podcast that very subject easily. Alone. But
we're at the birthday, Fletcher, right?
Now, Fletcher is in the meeting with Samantha Cole. And this is when he's convincing her that he will be his lawyer. And he does a fantastic job. Like, he throws in a Tina Turner reference. And, like, it is such an amazing scene where he's pitching. Because apparently there's a prenuptial agreement in this marriage. And we'll get to that later. But he's trying to tell her, like, hey, you were driven into the arm of another man, and she's
seven.
Seven other. And he's like, wait, what? She's like, what? Seven other men. And he's like, whatever.
It's female empowerment.
Here. Yeah. And so he gives this pitch that's amazing Jim Carrey scene where he's singing and fucking flailing about, and he sells it. And she, of course, gets up and is like, okay, she's confident that that's it. And she squeezes his ass and gives him a hug and whispers in his ear, like, I'm so glad to have a lawyer that I can be confident about, or whatever.
And the whole time the partner's watching, laughing and giggling in awe of his performance, that she's getting the vapors going.
Yeah,
you know what she's getting ready for.
Yeah, she's getting hot in the undercarriage, if you know what I mean. And of course, so Samantha Cole walks out, and that she's like, if you get this, this is worth so much money and you're going to make partner. How would you like to make a partner right now? And of course, he's like, okay. And they start to bang. And then somehow gets on the phone with his ex-wife saying that he can't be there while he's getting his pants undone.
Because his boss is really riding him.
The boss is really riding me. And so he chooses sex, not even necessarily career. He chooses sex over his son, too. You know,
and so it's meaningless sex, as we find out later on. He doesn't actually care about her in any kind of way.
Right. No, it's just sex.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is that he's having sex with his boss, one of the partners, while his son's making a wish, which makes me think, is the sex component of it sex magic at the same time?
Well,
that adds to the magic and the energy.
Or was it the fact that his angelic mother was there, since she's the angel kind of...
she's the supernatural godly one.
Yeah, she's the supernatural mother that's there, which she's not there when he tries to undo the wish. So... who knows? Maybe it is the sex magic that something was happening. So
this is what
it flashes to the party, and his son is devastated again because his dad didn't show up, and he's making a wish, his birthday wish, and he blows the candle out, and you hear like this twinkling type music, like something's happening.
But wait, there's a lot of things going on before this wish actually takes place. So as we said, he's choosing to sleep with the boss to not be his son's birthday. His family and friends are singing happy birthday to him. There's 5 candles on the cake. The cake is a baseball diamond. And as we know from the Great Deception podcast, Matt and Ryan from Dangerous World, the baseball diamond in sport is esoteric and Freemason in itself. It's a square and compass.
Right.
So we've got some of that symbolism going on. All the decorations in the room at that time are red. And the act of the birthday blessing, the singing, that could be construed or as seen as an esoteric chant to transfer energy to Max or to his mother through into Max so that he can make the wish.
Yeah. There was a clown at the beginning of the birthday scene too. And the only word you hear the clown say is happy. Mm-hmm. Comes in on the clown and he's just like, happy, 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 happy,
happy, happy.
So I wrote that down.
Everyone be happy.
That's creepy.
So, yeah, as you were saying, he's blown the 5 candles out. There's all that esoteric symbolism going on. There's a square and compass on the cake. There's red color everywhere. There's 5 candles. He's blown them out. We see the smoke start to billow up. There's that ominous music going. It starts to flow out a window up past a clock, and the clock displays 8:15, which I thought was just a weird time for a kid's birthday to be turning 5 to be having a cake at.
Right.
But that's just me.
8:15 p.m.
Yeah, I thought it would be like a day party, but anyway.
So the time done that at 8:15. The time in this whole movie is real weird. Everything is happening at very weird times and speeds.
Really strange. So the spell's been done. He's had sex with the boss. She rolls over and looks at him and says, was that as good for you as it was for me? And his words are, I've had better.
Which
and
is
that
so
is the first time he cannot lie. It's perfect. Yeah.
The first time he can't lie is about sex with his boss. And so she throws him out. And
yep,
he slides across the ground. She throws his clothes at him. And he just couldn't. He gets up and he mumbles to himself, I've had better.
Better.
And then the next scene is him waking up at 6 a.m. His alarm clock goes off. Yep, he wakes up and he says, I've had better. he's realizing, wait a minute, I've had better. Oh, God. A buddy of mine and I still quote this movie all the time. And that's one of the things that we'll use as a quote.
So he's woken up. He's realizing what he said, but it still hasn't dawned on him that he can't lie at this point. It's only once he gets to the courtroom that his inability to lie starts to come out in those typical Jim Carrey physical movements and facial distortions that he does. He can't explain.
There is a scene that we see where he realizes he can't lie, but he doesn't know the depths of it yet. And it's
on the bum.
No, the elevator in his hotel, in his building.
Yes.
That's the first time he can't lie. Is he walks into the elevator and there's this hot brunette with her boobs out. And
God, everyone's so nice
like,
to me.
He's like, oh, are you new to the building? And she says, yeah, everybody's been really nice. He goes, that's because your boobs are huge. I mean, I want to suck them.
I mean, mama. So yes, I take that. That is the first time, but it's still not, I don't think it's obvious to him yet.
Right. He hasn't really realized.
That's a good scene.
It's so good.
No.
We couldn't skip that.
And then
that
there's the same one. No, there's a scene where he then walks up the steps to the courthouse and the bum who was at the start of the film asking for money asks him again. He turns around and says, I'm not going to give you any money. The bum says something on the lines of, why won't you? He said, I'm afraid you're going to go spend it on booze.
Right.
And just runs up and he shocks that he actually says,
can you spare some cash? Yes. Well, will you? No.
No.
But why? Because I think I'm afraid you're going to go spend it on booze.
Booze.
This is when he's starting to get really frustrated. Like you can see he's forced. Not only can he can't even keep his mouth shut. Like he can't just not say anything. He has to respond in a truthful manner. So it's more that he just can't lie.
It's like it removes in a monologue.
Right.
He's forced
to tell the truth. To say what is going through his mind right at that moment. He has to say it. So that's when he gets up into his office and I think his secretary tries to stop him, but he goes into his office. He just walks past her like, hold all my shit. I'm going into the office. And there's yet another brilliant Jim Carrey scene where he is trying to lie about the color of a pen. And what color is he trying to say the pen is?
Red. Yep. There we go. And it's like he's pushing the limitations of what he can get away with. Like we know that he has to say things. He can't even write it down. He's I'll write it down. The color of this pen is and he starts writing blue. It's and he gets that typical over-the-top comedy that we love from him, but he can't even spell a word under this spell he's under. He can't spell the word red. He has to spell blue.
Yeah, he can't even write a lie.
He can't even write it. He can't say one lie and he can't even write it. Like you said, the written word is said to be a type of magic as well. Spelling. That's what we call it. Spelling. You're casting a spell through a written word. So it's ironic that he can't write it down under the spell he's under at the moment because of Max. He loses control of his hand. Physical comedy ensues where the hand, which is normally the claw that we see at the start of the film, which he has this fun banter with his son, it starts to physically write all over his face. And the receptionist walks in and he pops his head up from behind his desk and he's, the pen's blue. It's blue. And he can't reconcile the fact that he's assaulted himself. It's blue.
Yeah, and that's the moment where he's like, all right, I can't lie. I can't tell a lie. I can't write a lie. And so, and then he realizes that he's got to go to court. He's like, fuck, now I have to go to court.
Are you ready for this, though? Do you know what the blue represents as a color?
What?
It represents intelligence and responsibility, which he's always neglecting his responsibilities.
Yep. Yeah.
So he's literally wearing responsibility on his face that he's been neglecting the whole time.
Yeah, it's right on his face.
It is. Brilliant. And so, like you said, he has to go to this court case now. The most important court case of his career. It's either going to make or break him. He'll be partner or he won't. So what happens now?
So now he goes, this is when he goes to the courtroom, right? And he asks for a continuance, but it gets denied by the judge because the judge asks for a reason why he can't do it. And he says, I can't lie. And the judge says, well, that's very noble of you, but I'm still waiting for a reason why you can't go to court today.
Yeah.
So the judge says he has to go to court.
I love how the judge, when he sits down, goes, "How is everyone today?" And he pops onto his microphone. He says, "I'm a little bit upset from a sexual experience I had last night." The judge says, "Well, you are young. It's only going to become more and more often." I wouldn't try to dwell on it too much.
Right. Well, then he goes outside and he's trying to figure out how he can get over this. And so this is when Samantha Cole walks up with the dude she's been banging. And he tries to ask him a question, and he can't even get the question out. Because he knows the answer will be a lie. So he's trying to brainstorm as to what to do, and he can't lie. And I think at this point they go back into the courtroom, and he's waiting to go into the courtroom. And is this when it starts?
I think they get an extended lunch break, and he leaves the courtroom, because this is where the chaotic nature of not just his personal and career life,
when
his family life becomes chaotic.
Right. This is when he tells Audrey that he's going to come talk to her. Between, he has to be back in court at 1:30.
And this is where it leads up to Audrey. She's seen him fail Max for the last time, and she decides that she's going to move to Boston with Jerry because Jerry's proposed to her. And Max replies, she says, Max and I are moving to Boston. And Fletcher says, I thought this wasn't serious. And she says, well, it's just been given a violent shove into serious.
Yeah.
And what do you violently shove or thrust? Spear.
Ah.
So a spear's been violently shoved or thrust into that situation.
Yep. Old Jerry.
And she says it herself.
Yeah. So he says, don't go anywhere. I'll be right there. Like, I'm going to come talk to you. I'll be right there. And so he takes off, and he's speeding and cutting through traffic, and of course passes a police officer, and the police officer takes off from the stop that they're on, because apparently that stop wasn't very important, as all traffic stops are. And he goes after Fletcher and gets Fletcher pulled over. And Fletcher knows he can't lie to the cop. He's like, fuck, you can see it on his face. It's like, shit. And the cop says, do you know why I pulled you over? He says, depends on how long you were following me. And he's like, well, why don't we just start from the top?
Okay. He takes a deep breath, rattles through every single violation he made, and then tops it off with unpaid parking
the cop
tickets.
Says, and now, is that it?
No,
I have unpaid parking tickets, and opens the glove box, and they just come spilling out. So
yeah,
he obviously gets in trouble for that, and they impound his car. And the next scene is him pulling up to Audrey's house in a Royal Crown taxi that has yellow and black checkers with a crown, and it says Royal real big across it. I saw that and was like, well, shit. That's right there in our fucking face, isn't it? And she's leaving at that point in time. She is leaving. She had waited for him. He ended up getting his car impounded. And then she's like, wait a minute, did you just show up in a taxi? And he's like, yes, that's what I'm trying to tell you. Max's wish came true. I can't lie. And that's when he tells Audrey about what's going on. And so he needs Audrey to take him and get his car back.
And this is, you got to bail my car out. And they have there's a little bit of dialogue here I have to mention, that he says, and this is when she discloses, like, you know what, I'm marrying Jerry, we're moving. And she says, he says to her rather, are you marrying this guy because you're mad at me? And she says, no, I divorced you because I was mad at you. The magic of divorce is I don't have to care.
Yeah, the magic of divorce. I noticed that part too. I was like, well, they just spoke it right there. But at the same time, she does care about what he's doing.
Oh, she does. Absolutely.
Like, she definitely cares about what he is. She still loves him. He starts seeing it through this movie that she still loves him. She definitely doesn't love Jerry. Like, that is a matter of convenience and comfort, security.
He's a safety man.
He's safe. Yeah. He's the safe choice. He's got a really
feel
good
sorry
job.
For Jerry.
I know. He's a decent looking dude. Good
guy.
Job. Like,
cares, generally cares.
Yeah. Like, cares about the kid.
Yeah.
Like, wants a relationship with Max, and he gets it denied.
Come on, people may not have seen this film yet.
Yes, yeah. Geez, if you haven't seen this yet. So
They did you notice what happens when they're at the impound lot and he's got the scratch down the side of his car and he threatens that he's going to take them to court and then rattles through how timely and exhaustive it'll be and nothing will happen from it?
Yes.
And the guy at the impound lot's like, oh, you've been here before. And he goes, next time I'm coming back to shove this up your tailpipe.
Yeah.
Again, with the sodomy.
Well, that, and it just showed, like, he's describing the system that he works inside. It's like, it takes so much effort to get anything done in the system, and then it doesn't really matter anyway. Like, if you were to sue somebody, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Like, if you sue somebody for money, they don't have to pay you.
And yeah, so that's right.
Just like,
and the time and effort it can go through to actually make that happen is...
And they make the system like that on purpose.
More trouble than it's worth.
They make it like that on purpose.
So, yeah, like you said, she does give him one last chance. It's like she's decided that she's going to marry Jerry and move away, but she still feels so bad about the fact that it dawns on Fletcher, he says, okay, you're right, I'm a bad father. And then he has this pause and the realization that, holy shit, I'm a bad father.
Right.
And she says, you're not a bad father. And she tries to console him. So she gives him one last chance.
Well, she says, you're not a bad father when you're there.
When you're there, yes.
Like, yes, you're a bad dad, but it's because you're never around. When you're around him, you're great. But so next.
And this is when. Next? Yeah. And this is when she tells him, do you know what your son was doing last night at 8:15? And she tells the time again. He was making a wish that you couldn't lie for one whole day. And she takes off and goes, oh my God, that's it. And so it finally dawns on him that there's magic at play or a spell.
Yeah. So then he shows up at his son's school with a birthday cake, trying to get him to undo his wish.
I love the way that
he says, Max, I have to lie. I have to lie for work. You know, he says, sometimes grownups need to lie. He said, and then he tells Max, everybody lies. And Max's response is, but you're the only one that makes me feel bad. Which, dude, that yes, like, draws us in. God. That hurt straight so bad. Oof, that was just brutal.
I love the dialogue that he has with his son, where his son's trying to understand everything. So you can't lie? No, I can't lie. Your wish worked. And he rattles through, is wrestling real? And he goes, in the Olympics, yes. On ESPN, no. If I hold my face like this, will it freeze and be stuck like that?
Oh, no.
Oh, there we go, back.
Oh, there he is. All right. Yeah, all right. Slight glitch. Sorry, folks. All right. So he said, you were at the point where you said, if I hold my face like this, will it
freeze
stuck?
And stay that way? And he says, no, a matter of fact, some people make a good living that way. And then he kind of gives a slight nod to the camera, like, I'm the guy that makes my face crazy and I've got a good career out of it.
Yep. Yeah, that was the first time I noticed that.
He breaks the third wall.
Yeah, I noticed that one. And oh, shit.
So he comes there and he's trying to recreate the birthday party, right? But there's a lot of noticeable differences. He doesn't have the baseball diamond cake. He has a single number 5 candle, not 5 candles. But the birthday hats are red. So once again, the hats that they're wearing, there's a lot of red symbolism going on there. The son says, so they go through this thing. He's like, you got to make... Your wish go away. I have to be able to lie. He's like, okay, blows his candles out and he goes to test it. You see him saunter over to this mother, quite attractive mother, at a playground, and he has a chat to her and she's smiling. Then she stops and slaps him and he comes back and says, what'd you do? Did you get rid of it or not? And his son replies, last night when I wished it, I really meant it. Yeah. So he didn't mean this one.
And
so
he said, manifested this time, his reality. I only did it because you told me to.
Yep. So he manifested that reality through his wish. That's what I picked up.
Yep. Yeah. He cast the spell because it had the energy behind it. And then when he tried to undo it, it didn't have the same energy. So it didn't have any power because he didn't really mean it. He doesn't want his dad to lie. And when he tells his dad, but I don't want you to lie. And this is when he realizes that he needs to try to get out of this that he's in. He needs to postpone it somehow because it's a 24-hour curse. And I think somebody says that. It's like he's talking to somebody. I can't lie. It's like a 24-hour curse. And that's what he says, a 24-hour curse.
Yeah, and this is when the boss overhears him say it too. And she puts him in a compromising position later on.
Yeah. And so, this is the boardroom scene. I think.
Yes.
Where he goes into the boardroom. This is where she takes him and goes, oh, yeah.
She sets him up. So what do you think about the boss? Tell me.
Yeah.
Tell me what you think about him.
Pulls him into the conference room where the head boss is there with like all the board members. And she says, why don't you tell him what you think of him? And so he says what he had said out in the hall, that he's, you know, a pontificating asshole or whatever.
And a narcissistic personality, everything under the sun.
Yeah. And the boss freaking thinks it's hilarious. And
he thinks it's like, a roast. Oh, I love roasts.
Yeah, he's like, do him. And so he starts going through and just roasting everybody at the table, which it looks like he's completely out of control at this point. He's possessed almost, mm-hmm. to where this stuff is just coming out of him. And you can see it's exhausting him. Like it's draining his energy because he has no control over it. And so he goes through and roasts them all. And when he gets done, he's exhausted. He got no enjoyment out of that, though we're all laughing, you know. But for him, it's this fucking like painful thing that he's going through that he can't stop from happening.
It's that possession thing we continually say through his films, isn't it?
Yeah, and especially this one with the claw and then the pen. And then all of these things where this stuff comes bursting out of him, trolling.
Completely involuntary. And you see that in when he's trying to, he does that stereotypical like Living Color mouth manipulation stuff where he's pulling his mouth apart, trying to stop the words to come out.
Yeah.
He's the perfect actor for this, but there's a lot going on there. And I'm so glad we've done this series.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we finish with the boardroom with the roasting session where he gives everyone a dressing down and a hose down for who they are. And he goes back into the courtroom and he's trying to get out of court in a really, really subtle way. He's sitting there drinking water the whole time, necking it down as the defense is there popping up. The prosecution's there giving their case and he's downing all this water. And it finally dawns on him, oh, I need a rest break. I need to go to the toilet. He says, why do you need to go to the toilet? Because I've read somewhere that it can cause erectile dysfunction. And the judge goes, in that case, I better go too. We'll meet back in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And what is it that he does in the bathroom, Bob?
Oh, this is probably one of the greatest Jim Carrey scenes of all time. It is spectacular. He's sitting there taking a piss and he's banging his head on the wall. And he's like, how am I going to get out of this? And he hits his head and he goes, owie. And a light bulb comes on. And he's like, owie. All right. And he goes to the mirror and just starts punching himself in the face, and then he like kicks the heater in the furnace that's in the corner, and he's ripping his clothes apart, and there's some random dude that walks in the middle of this and is watching him throw himself around the bathroom. He shoves his head into a toilet and smashes his face with the toilet seat. And he comes out, that's when he kicks the heater, and he stomps on his toe, and he's turning around, and the guy goes, what the hell are you doing? He goes, I'm kicking my ass, do you mind? And it is one of the most brilliant scenes. I love it still to this day. It's just so good. It's just everything you want from Jim Carrey. In this scene, it is spectacular.
It's perfect. And then it jumps forward a little bit, and we see that a lot of time has actually passed. He's been in that bathroom for a little while now. And one of the guards or the cops that works within the courthouse, he's walking him in over his shoulder. And he goes, I found him like this in the bathroom, Your Honor. Someone beat the hell out of him. And the judge said, who did this? And he goes, a madman, Your Honor, a madman.
A desperate man at the end of his pitiful rope.
Which is not a lie. So he was able to say that.
What does this guy look like? 6'2", kind of gangly, big teeth.
And I don't know if it's directly at this point, somewhere in this courthouse scene within this last part of the movie, he says that I've slipped into the seventh circle of hell.
It's after this.
So after it, right.
Yeah, The judge says to him, he's like, look, in spite of all of this, I have no option but to delay this case until you're okay, unless you think you continue. And he's like, you see it. He's fuck. And the judge goes, well, can you continue? And he laboringly is like, yes. Like it's painful. He's like, shit. So the judge gives him a little bit of time to compose himself. Judge says, all right, we'll take a little recess. You go compose yourself and we'll get to it. And this is where Miss Cole comes back out to him and talks to him. And I think this is the part where the part with Falk actually happens, where he tries to ask
Falk man number a question seven.
And he can't. But this is where Samantha Cole is like, "Are you okay?" And he goes, "I've slipped into the seventh circle of hell." like, there's so much of that stuff in this that it's just like, wow. And okay.
At this point, right, you would think there's no way that he's going to win this case. He can't lie. There's a lot of evidence that's showing that Mrs. Cole is the wrongdoer in this situation, to the point where once they start getting witnesses on the stand, he starts berating his own witnesses and badgering them to the point where they're admitting their faults. And you're thinking, oh, this is a great case closed. He's going to lose this for sure.
He calls Falk to the stand. So he gets back into the court, and his first witness is the guy that Miss Cole's been banging. And he starts badgering the witness, and the prosecutor says, "He's badgering the witness." And the judge goes, "It's his witness."
He gets him so overwhelmed and wound up that he says, "Yeah, all right, I did it. I banged her. I banged her brains out."
And he goes, "No more questions." And he goes and sits down, just out of it. And the judge asks the prosecutor, "Do you have any questions?" She's like, "No questions. Like, this is okay. We're done here." And this is where Samantha Cole yanks him to the side, and he's like, "I can't lie." And she's like, "I am not going to waste all of this. I'm 31 or whatever. And, you know, this, I'm not going to let this happen," whatever she said. And another light bulb goes off for him. And he's like, "Wait, you're how old?" And so that's when he realizes that she lied about her age.
Yeah, the truth has set him free in this situation.
Yeah, which he even says at one point in time. So then he, you know, the judge is about to drop the gavel and say, "This case is closed." And he stands up and he goes, "Wait, I call Samantha Cole." And yet another amazing Jim Carrey scene. He has her driver's license. "So is this your driver's license?" She's like, "Yes." And he's like, "Okay. Says here you weigh 105 pounds." "Right. In your bra."
And it says are you a blonde?
Says you're a blonde. Yeah. And she's like, "No, I'm not a blonde." And he's like, "Well, that's not true either." It says, "What about your birthday? What does that say?" And she's like, "1964. And he's like, "But that's not true either, is it?" And that's when he pulls out the birth certificate and says, "Look, she was actually 17 when she married him. And in state of California, you have to be 18 to enter into any contracts.
A minor cannot be married without parental consent."
Yeah, well, a minor can't engage in a contract, including prenuptial agreements, which makes this agreement null and void, and she has the right to half the marital assets, or $11.5 million, which is just insane.
And the courtroom starts clapping in applause, like he's pulled it off. He's come from complete failure to he's found that small little scare of truth, which is a loophole that he managed to pull off, and he's won the case. And people start clapping, like, you don't see that in courthouses.
Yeah, and the guy, the head lawyer that he had roasted earlier, says, "Son of a bitch, pulled it off." Like, because if it's like any other court fee, it's, you know, that law firm just got like 40% of the case. So 40% of $11.5 million, which means that law firm just got like $5 million, which I'd be happy.
It was so close to being a six, too. That was really almost a rounding error.
Almost. So this is when, and then the judge says, "Well, you know, we're agreeing to 50-50 custody, right?" And prosecution says, "Yes, 50-50. And that's when she's like, "No, now I'm going to hit him where it hurts." And he's like, "But you said he's a good father." Like, this is where he realizes that he's done something completely fucking terrible. You know, he's taken away this. Not only has he, you know, won this stupid ass court battle, but now he's taking kids away from a good dad. And so his entire character arc through this movie is him realizing that being a good dad is important, which, I mean, that's like trying to make Tropic Thunder now. Like, they would never allow you to make a movie where the dad is the good guy.
Dads are dumb, and they're second fiddles to the wives and families now, and they bring no value to families whatsoever.
Babbling doofuses, generally.
Idiots like on Modern Family that go and
complete
buy
fuck ups or something. Yeah, yeah, it's insane.
And you feel genuine heartache for the kids. Like, you see the kids' reaction to this as well.
Right.
And she's leaving, Mrs. Cole's leaving with the kids. She's reefing them out of the courtroom. And one of the kids says, I want to stay with daddy, breaks off her arm, runs over to him, starts cuddling him. And what she says just gives us the best insight into her psyche. Let go of those. They are mine. Not
you haven't paid for them yet.
Like, they're possessions, not actually people.
Yeah. Yep. Which that puts into the psyche that children are possessions. You know, I tell my kids, like, I don't own you. I'm just your steward. No, you don't. Nobody owns you. Nobody gets to tell you what to do. Like, I'm here to make sure you don't grow up to be an asshole. And that's my job. Like, as a dad, I'm just here to make sure you don't grow up to be a prick. Other than that, you own yourself, man. Like, don't get it twisted. Anybody that says otherwise is lying to you. And it's insane that, you know, in the system that we're in this movie, they basically tell you that she's going to win that case. Like, she's certain she's going to win. The dad is certain that she's going to win. You know, Fletcher is certain that she's going to win. And it's not because she's the better parent. Which, as somebody in the middle of a custody battle, that shit hits deep with me, because my son's mom isn't as big of a piece of shit as Samantha Cole, but she ain't fucking far off. And the judges all side with her, no matter what. They won't even listen to me. I had a judge tell me to shut up and not talk until I was spoken to recently, and I had a really hard time keeping my mouth shut. Luckily, my lawyers were there, so I was able to, like, yeah. And I told my lawyers afterwards, I was like, I was about to say something. They were like, good job not saying anything. I was like, fuck that guy. Like, the next time he tries to tell me I can't speak until I'm spoken to, I'm going to give that dude a piece of my mind. Like, and that's the thing. And you see this at the end when Fletcher goes to the judge and he's like, dude, we just did some horrible shit, man.
The ramifications of what he's done. And the judge, he realizes the damage he's done to those kids.
Yeah. And now this exposes the flaws of the system, that the judges that have been tasked to look at facts and determine a judgment can be controlled and manipulated through emotion, because Fletcher pisses this judge off and the judge
holds
him
in contempt.
When all Fletcher's trying to do is tell him, hey, man, we just fucked up, dude. Like, we just did a really, really bad thing. And the judge says, don't question me in my own courtroom. Like, if that's not telling you how fucked up the system is,
and you're the most enlightening.
That's one of the things I noticed, was how they paint the system.
And even as a system, it even leads the entire time. You like the judge. The judge seems like a decent, nice guy, until this final piece of dialogue with Fletcher, where he doesn't care about the actual ramifications of what's happened. He doesn't care about what's happened to those kids. It's his courtroom and his ruling, and that's it. And that's the biggest issue.
Right. Well, and at one point in time, when Fletcher is badgering the witnesses, he says something to, it's when he calls Samantha Cole to the stage. Freudian slip. To the stand, the judge says, it's only through morbid curiosity that I'm even allowing this charade to continue. Yeah.
He is the god in that courtroom, and that's probably the way a lot of judges see themselves.
Yes, they do. Having interacted with a lot of judges, they see themselves as higher, as like anointed people. When, I'm sorry, judges, you were elected by a group of retards. You're not anointed with anything. And that goes out to any judge to hearing this. I don't care who you are. If you're a judge, you ain't special.
Quick one. You know, he's off the prosecution, the redheaded woman, again, red hair. Her name is Dana Appleton. Dana means arbiter of God, or God is my judge. Weird.
Oh, shit.
So the case is...
when she's the one fighting for, you know, the
good
side,
that's right.
Good.
So the case is over. He's realized what he's done, the ramifications of what he's done to that poor family. And he tried to stand up for them. He gets thrown in contempt and put into jail. Greta's the one that bails him out. His receptionist, his secretary. She comes in, pays...
Well, and he was supposed to meet Max after the court case, And he gets carried out of the courtroom screaming, "I'm Jose Canseco! I'm going to see my son.
I'm Jose Canseco."
Yeah. So, but then, yes, of course, Greta, the beaming light, she comes to save it.
And he has this, it dawns on him that he's, as a defender, he's being in the wrong team, so to say. And he says, "I'm going to go start my own law firm. Do you want to come work for me?" And she goes, "You couldn't afford me." And they laugh and they hug and they reunited once again. But he's then pressed for time to try and stop Max and his wife from leaving with Jerry. He gets to the airport. And this is one thing that stood out for me. I don't know if you noticed it. As we see the runway, there's an emphasis on a plane that has one logo name on it. Transworld. Transworld.
Yep. I wrote it down. Transworld. Yep. Yeah, there was Transworld. What else did I see? I was pointing it out all to my wife. There was a few different things, and I can't think of them all now. I freaking forgot to write them down because I ran out of room on my page. But there were a few things that happened at the airport where it's like, oh shit! It was like a couple different planes, maybe a number on a plane. That whole scene is kind of hilarious. And then so he's trying to chase down this airplane that has Max on it, and he commandeers a baggage load, this like thing that goes up to the airplane, this electronic staircase basically, and he takes off on it and chases down the airplane, which is just kind of crazy to think about.
And he doesn't even get sucked into the engine. He goes right past one. Come on.
Yeah. As it's moving down the road, like down the runway, you know, moving this giant airplane. So an insane amount of thrust has to be coming out of those jets. And he's just like, oh, like it's not and even that big of a deal.
He gains the attention of the pilot by throwing a shoe at the window. And the pilot goes, "What the hell was that?" "I think it was a shoe." Now, was this before George Bush had a shoe thrown at him in Iraq?
Oh, I don't know. That would be interesting.
That was the only thing that dawned on me.
But then he's like, but so he gets up to the window before he gets to the pilots. He gets up to the window and his son sees him and he's telling Max that he's not going to let him go. And so then that's when he goes up to the front of the airplane, throws a shoe at the window. And the pilot's like, "Oh shit, there's a maniac on the freaking runway. We got to shut this down." And they like hit the brakes to where the tires are all smoking. And they're like, was that necessary? But of course, you know, Fletcher continues to go forward and hits some barricade and flies off of it and lands in a bunch of baggages. And I missed the numbers and I didn't back it up because it was kind of late and I was tired. But these two baggage carts collide, like this whole event causes these two baggage carts to collide together. And there's got to be something, maybe there was a cut scene where baggages got lost or something. But that had to have happened for a reason. But he goes into these bags, and he's covered, and he just passes out. And then you see him on the stretcher. Like, that's the next scene, is him kind of getting loaded up, and there's lights and sirens and all the commotion around what's going on. And he's talking to Max. Max is out of the airplane and down with his dad. And what is, how's this conversation start with Max? Do you have any notes?
I don't. But the one thing that came for me is that I think it's the first time he actually says, "I love you, Max," in the entire film. Like, we know he loves his son, but it's the first time he actually verbalizes it to him.
Yeah. And he's saying this stuff. He's talking to Max and he's like, "I love you. I don't ever want to hurt you. I don't want you to go to Boston." And that's when Max looks up at mom. He's like, "Do we have to go to Boston?" And his mom looks at Jerry and Jerry says,
"You don't have to
go. No, man, you don't have to go to Boston, but I do." And that's where we see that Jerry is taken out of the picture and he's going to go. And so Fletcher's talking to Max and he's like, I'm never going to lie to you again. Like, I love you and I'm going to be there for you and all of this. And you know, it's true because I can't lie to you. And then he looks at his watch and he sees that he's been able to lie for 30 minutes. And so he's like, "Max, I've been able to lie for 30 minutes. And so Max's immediate instinct is, "So you were lying. So you were lying about it." And he's like, no, I just want to be honest with you. I'll never lie to you again. And I'm going to do everything I can to be there for you," or whatever he says. And so that's when that's when it cuts to like a year later, and it's his next birthday, and they're at the mom's house, and they're doing a birthday, and Max is about to make a wish. And so they sing him happy birthday. He blows the candles out, and it gets dark, and the lights come back on, and the Audrey and Fletcher make it out.
And Fletcher turns to Max. Max!
I think it's so messed up. He's like, Max! Did you wish for your mom and dad to get back together? Like all upset about
No, I wish for rollerblades.
I thought that scene was pretty funny, where
Audrey turns to him and says, do you want some cake? Dad. She no longer calls him Fletcher anymore. That sets the tone that they're reunited and they're a family again. But the whole time, I just can't help but feel sorry for poor Jerry. Even in the last scene we see Jerry, he says, this is an open ticket, by the way. You know, you can still come up and see me. And he knows it's over, but he still has to have that, like that olive branch or thing to hand out. Like, it's okay. It could happen. The poor guy is just oblivious.
Well, he loves her. He admitted her love on the airplane. And it's one of those scenes where the guy says, I love you. And she says,
thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
That's not the response I was looking for.
And that's when I think that's the moment where Jerry realizes she doesn't like this is not what's going to work out. So then, you know, the movie ends with you like thinking that they got back together, that they're back together and it's a family, big happy ending, you know, close movie.
Now, I might be having a Mandela effect here, but throughout watching this, I thought this was the ending that happened. And I went to see if it was a deleted scene or if it was just a version that was released in Europe or Australia, because often we have movies that are slightly different from what you guys get. I thought for sure that was coming up at that wish part was instead of saying, I wish for rollerblades, he said, I wish for a little sister. That's in my memory, solid. I don't know if it's from another movie or if I'm just misremembering, but I was certain that he wished for a little sister. And that was what facilitated the kiss. And it's not there.
Man, now that you say that, that does sound familiar. I don't know if it's this movie or not, because I do remember Max, like when I was watching it last night, like I remember he asked for roller skates. Like before the scene played, I knew what he was going to ask for. But now that you say that, maybe it was like a deleted scene or something. I don't know. Now I'm going to have to look in to see what movie they say that. If it wasn't this one or some deleted scene or alternate.
But it was something to do with the wish. And that's what made me think maybe I've missed something. But yeah.
But, you know, the wish, you know, there wasn't the same. You think there's the same twinkle with the wish until he says that. And then it's just a regular kid's wish, you know, which, you know, obviously didn't immediately come true. So there was whatever magic the previous one, because what does he say? What are the odds of it happening? Like, he's about to blow out the candle and they look at each other and they're like, and it's like, what are the odds of it happening again? It's like, well, what are the odds of it happening in the first place? So it's like, come on. If you apply that same standard, you've had it happen once, so it can happen twice. And that's why he immediately is like, Max. But you don't know. Maybe Max did wish for his parents to get back together, but then he lied to his parents about what he wished for.
He's father's son. He knows how to do it.
Right. So we don't know if Max didn't lie. We can
imply that for sure. So the entire point of this film is we've seen an inverse of the Jim Carrey trope of the good guy that has to become somewhat of a bad guy to overcome his challenges. This time it's the inverse of that. He starts off as a bit of a bad guy, scumbag, and becomes a good guy in his hero's journey. The whole time, his name is so true to chaos and chaos magic. Red Arrow. The entire film is chaotic. It's a Jim Carrey trope that we're seeing. That was very evident throughout watching this whole film.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is chaos stem to stern. I mean, from the very beginning to the very end, it's all chaotic. And that's also, you know, the psychological aspect of always having those change of things, you know, because they do that with kids movies and kids shows, is there's always something going on. So it always keeps your attention. And so that relays that chaos into our minds as viewers. You know, not only it's putting chaos into our mind just by having so much action constantly through the entire movie. So the psychological aspect of what it's doing to the audience, and not just being, you know, just viewers, but this movie is doing psychological things to people that they don't even realize is happening.
What a dive. What an absolute dive on that one. You put it so well that it's the psychological things. Like, we know there might be word magic in it, or esotericism, all these types of things that we know about as people in our community. But sometimes it's just the hard science of films, television, they're all psychological mechanisms to make us feel and think a certain way.
Yeah. I mean, it's programming. They call it that, you know, and through Operation Mockingbird, they admit that they want to control us through these avenues. So, you know, it's just, they put it all there. So you have to kind of understand, and a lot of people don't understand that, you know, movie productions have teams of psychologists looking over, telling them what to put on the scene, what to put in there, especially to keep your attention or lay a certain message or cause a certain emotional response. You know, there's all of this stuff done because they know how it's supposed to play out through your head to keep your attention and keep you invested and make you want to watch the movie. And so, I mean, even at the most basic level or the most innocent level, they want to keep your attention, you know, so they've got to know how to put this movie together to keep your attention the entire time. And some movies don't do that. Those are the movies that, you know, you'll watch and you're like, well, it was kind of slow, you know, or you just straight up fall asleep, which happens to me more often than not when I'm watching a movie, because I usually can't sit down to watch any of this stuff until like 9:30 at the earliest. And man, by 9:30 with all these little ones running around, my wife and I, we're exhausted. As soon as she puts her head on my shoulder, that's kind of like a button for me to fall asleep too. It's hard to stay awake when she's laying on me. So, but you know, this is all programming. Every aspect of this movie has,
I think, intention. They've nailed the perfect combination of science and magic of what we know them to be. It could have been in the past, they're probably the exact same thing that we're speaking about, but at the moment, it's very evident there's two different approaches that are happening within the same context.
Yep. Yeah, I think they have merged spirituality and technology brilliantly. And I think that was, you know, one of their main goals was to merge those two things seamlessly. And
think about it now. Look, they're getting emotional reactions out of us. We're identifying with characters based on what we're seeing and what we're hearing, just through those senses. Just wait till there's Neuralink or some kind of like virtual reality suite you go into where you can actually feel what's happening. What kind of control and manipulation could happen in that context?
Well, they can, you know, to the point to where they can log all of the data of your actual emotional response, not what they want to trigger. And maybe they can still track all of that now. Maybe they're able to read our energies in a way that we don't even know about. Because, I mean, I have definitely thought about things and then had them show up on my phone. And I'm like, man, I didn't even say that shit out loud. Like, so I think they could potentially read our energies now, but if they can't, with Neuralink, I mean, Klaus Schwab has even said it. He's like, we're going to be able to, you know your emotional response or how someone saying something to you makes you feel. And they're going to log that data and they're going to freaking use it against you, most likely.
Well, there's a reason. There's a,
like, to be able to have how your emotions are triggered and have the data of how every single individual has a certain emotional response triggered. And then
there's a camera watching you as you're watching YouTube or TikTok. It's picking up the subtle little variations in your face as you're responding to videos. And often that'll change your algorithms. Like I grabbed my wife's phone one day and we just did a test. We said certain words. I looked at certain things in her search engine. We spoke about certain things around her phone. More so a lot of less physical putting in data into the phone, more about speaking around it and talking about it. Without a doubt, those things popped up later that week. And it was in the sequence that we spoke about.
Yeah. Oh, shit. It was even in chronological order. Holy shit. That's insane, man. Like, I don't think people understand how deep the control is. Like, I really don't think most people understand how intense the level of control of this world is. Like, people are like, oh, you just think they control everything. Yes, I do. And there's a lot of evidence to back it up. I mean, all you got to do is look at movies like this. You know, they're clearly trying to send messages in this stuff. They're clearly trying to, you know, alter our psychological and emotional response to things. And I think it's more powerful than we give it credit. That's why I like doing these movies, man. It's like these things go deep and you don't even have to know what's happening. And that's what, like I said earlier in the episode, I think they put this stuff in there and we are some kind of conduit for this energy. We consume it and, you know, we pass that energy through and it does something, whether we know it or not. You know, it's like when if you grab a telephone wire and you don't touch the ground, the energy will pass right through you and get shocked. Well, it's something like that. Like this energy is passing through us and we have no idea it's doing it.
I think it's more obvious. Like we're going back through older films. These are films we grew up with. We've seen hundreds of times before. We've never picked up on it. Like we could look at a brand new movie and people like us would go, that symbolism there, this means that, this means this. Brand new movies, it's plain as day. When we go back through things we grew up with, things we weren't aware of, that's far more shocking. And it's a greater revelation, I think, because we're actually seeing the veil come
it's up. It's not as... Well, and it's not as obvious. Like they used to hide it a lot better, or they cared about hiding it better, or maybe they had to hide it better then because people were more intellectual and questioned things more. So they had to hide it. Well, now it's all just right there. It's all very.
Do you know, it'd be a really interesting thing for us to do once this series is over and we join with Andy and we've got the three of us. We need to pick a film that's black and white. I don't know, maybe 1940s, 1950s, and look for something further back to see if it's even less obvious, if we can even pick up on anything.
Yeah.
But cultures change, the dynamics of the messaging they want to put out is probably very different. But I dare say they've been doing this since they had people on a screen.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look at movies like The Newsbenders and what was the other one? I'm drawing a blank for the other one. Oh, The Network, where... You know, they openly say, like in The Network, the guy's like, you're being programmed. Turn this shit off. Turn it off. Like, and that was in the 70s. And The Newsbenders is like from 68. And Newsbenders is about, you know, one of the branches of the people that control everything. They control the news. And there's, you know, the people that control the markets and people that control the military and the people that control, you know, there's, I think he, in that movie, there's six branches that control the world. And then, you know, this dude is interviewing with the branch that controls and creates the news. I mean, that movie Newsbenders is about creating the news for years later. So they've been telling us this shit forever. And I've even seen stuff as far back as 1950 where it's like, holy shit. Because I think Operation Mockingbird officially kicked off in the 50s, but I think they were doing it far before that, especially if you look at like old Disney stuff. Like Disney stuff is creepy when you go back to some of the original Disney stuff. Like there's a lot of very pedophilic stuff.
Like and hypersexualized things that you don't notice just by looking at it. Right. Really messed up stuff.
Like there's a lot of crazy shit, and it goes way back before the actual creation of Operation Mockingbird, which, I mean, if they're doing this stuff, why are they making them official documents? Like, there's got to be something to that, right?
You would assume so, wouldn't
you? Where it's like, why do you have Operation Mockingbird?
All right, Bob, what's next for us? We've got one more film up our sleeves for this series.
We've got one more. Yeah, it's going to be Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind, which I think is going to be a great one to cap off.
I actually haven't seen this one, so this will be really interesting. It's been a absolute trouble trying to track it down Australia. It's been discontinued. I've looked at garage sales. I've really looked to try to download it. Can't find a digital source. Managed to get a physical copy off eBay, which is cool. That should be arriving. So you can watch that.
Okay, sweet. Because I think I can get it on Amazon. Yeah, so
should pop up very soon.
I think. Awesome. So we'll let me know when you get it. And we'll schedule beautiful. One once you get it. Because that one is going to be a doozy. That one is about Mandela effect and deleted memories, and it's really, really trippy. So I'm excited. I haven't seen that one in probably 20 years since it like was a fairly new movie. So I haven't seen that one in a long time. And I remember we would do drugs and watch it back in the day. So it's going to be weird to see that one now. It's one of the ones that I haven't watched in a very, very long time. So Well, dude, as you see, my kids have bombarded me, and they are hungry for my attention, or just they think they're on camera. They don't realize that this isn't. Yeah, he can see you, but nobody else is gonna see this. Okay. All right, guys. All right.
What a perfect way to end it. It's been an episode about fatherhood, and then kids on cue. Yeah. That's not planned, though. That was just completely natural.
Kids coming in. Yeah, that was completely natural. So now I have to put my work down and go hang out with my kids because they are hungry for my attention. So, Drew, thanks again, brother. Dude, I love doing this stuff with you, man, and I look forward to the next one because it's going to be a good one. But tell everybody where they can find
you. I'm Drew Misson from Your Missing the Point podcast. You can find me on Podbean, iTunes, all your regular podcatchers, and I'm listed as Missing the Point on Instagram.
Yeah, man. Go check out his stuff, guys. Drew does really good work, and his Instagram feed is pretty stellar. And he's just a brilliant mind, a guy that I am happy to call a friend. I, of course, am Moral Bob. You can find my podcast, Hidden in Plain Sight, on all your podcatchers. And until next time, you guys just enjoy life, watch movies, and laugh at all the crazy shit the controllers put in everything. It's really not hard to see. You don't have to go as deep as Drew and I go to see some crazy shit in these movies. So, man, thanks again. This was Movie Minds. And we'll catch you guys on the next one.
See you guys. Bye.
See you later.
Closing time. You don't gotta go home, but you can't stay here.